You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, June 14th, 2017, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Steve, welcome back.
Yeah, how was
Thank
the trip?
Thank you. The trip was awesome. Vienna is such a beautiful, beautiful city. Mm. Have any of you guys been? Kara, have you ever been to Vienna?
Yeah, I've been to Vienna. I liked it. I just thought there was like a slight cheese factor, I thought. Like, I really enjoyed it, but you do more often than you would think see people walking down the street in powdered wigs.
What?
No. When were you there?
Really?
I was there over the summer, maybe like 5 or 6 years ago.
And is there like a festival going on or something?
I don't know, but it definitely...
I didn't see a single powdered wig outside of, you know, like the theater, you know?
That's really good.
But what's with the powdered wigs?
Well, you know, Vienna's heyday was the time of Mozart, you know? Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of Mozart stuff going on. Freud as well, the famous... person from Vienna. But it's a, you know, it's a very beautiful, clean city, massive buildings, beautiful architecture, like classic European architecture. Everyone was super nice. Pretty much everyone speaks English. You know, very rarely did we encounter someone who didn't speak enough English to get through the interaction. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
So my wife and I said, all right, we're going to do the one stupid touristy overpriced thing. We did the carriage ride with the horses.
Oh, fun.
It's fun. And it's also, it was the first day we were there. It's like, let's just do it, get a feel for the city. You know, you go around, they show you everything. And then, because we basically could walk everywhere from our hotel.
Awesome.
You know, like, cool. From our hotel to like almost the far end of the city, it's like 20-minute walk. I mean, you can, and then if you want to, you can use, they have a really good metro system. They call it the U, you know, for the underground, but they also have buses and trams. So between the three of them, you could pretty much get anywhere, or you could just walk, you know, most places. But we took the carriage ride, which was cute, but the person giving the ride, you know, was pointing everything out, and it was just completely worthless. They were providing no information whatsoever because
like that's a building over there.
Yeah, so basically, it's like if you look to your left, you'll see a German sounding name, and then over here to your right, there's another German sounding name. And I could barely hear what they were saying. And whenever I could make out what they were saying, the name of the building was on the side of the building. So they basically we could have gotten all the information that they gave us just by reading the plaques on the buildings that we were driving by. And then she would like do that thing where she would start to talk, then turn back to the front, and you couldn't hear a word she was saying because all you hear is the clopping of the hooves on the cobblestone. The other thing I realized, though, on that trip is that cobblestone streets suck. They are pretty, but like carriage wheels on a cobblestone street are terrible. Like, is that how everyone got around? Could you imagine 200 years ago when all
peasants.
The streets were cobblestone? There was like no, you know, pavement, and everyone was getting around in carriages. That was terrible. It was the most bumpy ride I've ever had in my life. Most of the streets were paved. Every now and then we would hit a stretch of cobblestone streets. Like, oh my God, this is what travel was like back then. It was terrible.
Steve, do you notice how the weirdest part for me when I travel internationally is coming home and everything's in English again?
Yeah.
Like you almost get used to everything just sort of being Greek to you. Like you can't read anything anywhere you go. And you start making it out and you like get sort of good at recognizing why street signs look the way they do and different. And then you get home and you're like, how boring. Everything's in English.
Yeah, no. It was kind of fun trying to puzzle out all the signs. Like at one point, Jocelyn's like, what's Einbahn Street? Why do I see so many signs for Einbahn Street? I'm like, Joss, that's one way.
So, Steve... to state the obvious, you were in Austria.
Yes.
And one of my favorite human beings is from Austria, Arnold Schwarzenegger. So, you know, what's the deal? Do they really talk like him there or what happened?
No, I did not encounter one person who sounded like Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Arnold.
He is from a town called Graz, which is it's more on the German border, I think. We visited Graz, but it's true. Nobody there talks like him either.
No, the accent was very subtle. It's nothing like, you know, the sort of fake theatrical accent that we make fun of sometimes. And the language itself is very pretty. It was fun listening to people speak German all the time.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very interesting language to listen to. But here's something else I realized. And think about this. Think about your entire life. What percentage of the time in your life when you heard somebody speaking German, were they a Nazi?
Right.
Oh, my God.
I know what you're saying.
80%. Yeah, probably
right.
80%.
Probably like 80, 90%. I mean, every movie where an American hears somebody speaking German, probably there's a connection there. And yep. I realized just how programmed that was in my head. Like, when you hear German, that's the immediate association. It's terrible. But that's, I mean, every
that
movie that we – think about any German character and, you know, in any movie that you saw or TV show.
It's all conditioning.
Well, I mean, and there are stereotypes that are there for a reason, right? Like the German language is beautiful when you're being poetic and being beautiful, but it can also sound quite harsh, the same way the English language can sound quite harsh to certain ears, whereas the Italian language is much more sing-songy and the French language can sound a little snobby. A lot of that is stereotype, but it's also just the timbre of the language itself.
Yeah. But well, yeah, I think we hear a very narrow range of what is quote unquote, that German language.
That's
There's
true.
There's actually lots of different accents within German.
Mm. And, oh, yes. Oh,
and that
yes.
The more harsh one that we're used to hearing on movies is not, necessarily representative of every region that speaks German,
Right. Not this angry, harsh sort of rhetorical way of speaking.
We also can't really tell them apart. And it's similar when I always try to ask people when they're visiting the States, like a scientist will be in a visiting lab and they have a really thick accent but they speak English really well. But I'll say, can you hear different English accents and English dialects? And they almost never can. They're like, no, I can't tell the difference between somebody who lives in the Midwest or somebody who lives. But the one that they can point out is that they can sometimes hear deep, deep Southern accents.
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Makes sense too.
Steve, what was your number one experience?
Well, we went to a Mozart concert, which is very, very good.
Awesome.
And at the end, they played the Blue Danube, which is not by Mozart, but I guess that's the city's theme song, because that was a real crowd pleaser. And I did hear that in other places while we were there. And of course, it's one of my favorite pieces, partly because of the association with 2001. And I, when you hear a piece like that played live, it is just so much better. Just because you capture so much more of the nuance, and you see the musicians playing, you kind of see and hear aspects of the piece that you don't really pick up if you're just listening to a recording of it. It was really beautiful, very emotional. So that was fantastic. But everything we did was great. It was, again, I thought it was a beautiful city. We had a great time. Everyone was very, very nice. And the conference was good. I gave a lecture on science-based medicine.
At the
Vienna Medical University, which I pointed out was the university that gave a degree to the guy who invented iridology.
Oh, no.
Oh.
A lot of homeopathy in Austria.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's big in the German-speaking
German
areas.
And Austria, mm-hmm. very big, yeah. One thing, as Americans, especially in any city we go to, you could always find a Quickie Mart at 10 o'clock or 11 o'clock at night, right?
Yeah, you could pop into Walgreens or Rite Aid.
Whatever. 8 o'clock at night, shut down. That's it. Completely shut down. Couldn't get anything.
Really?
And
a major city?
No diet, nothing.
Ah!
No, I know, but how good is the food?
Oh, the food is awesome. Although I have to say... Good. Of course, I had a Wiener Schnitzel, which is like their signature dish. There's an Austrian restaurant right near where I live, in one town over, and the food there is really incredible. And I was, waiting to see how is it going to compare to Viennese food, and it actually compares favorably to what I had in Vienna.
That chef, he's
Austrian, and he moved to Connecticut and opened up a restaurant. He apparently is very good, because his stuff is as good as anything I had in Vienna.
Wow.
But the food in Vienna was off the hook. Every meal I had there was really, really good.
But no diet? Anything?
But no diet, anything. So, every store had the exact same, like, five soft drinks. Coke Light, right? Not Diet Coke, but Coke Light, just
right.
Like less sugar.
Yeah.
And then, like, Fanta Orange, Sprite, and this, like, carbonated apple drink or whatever, and which is actually not that bad. But there was, like, nothing with aspartame, nothing with Splenda. I even went to the grocery store, like, all right, I'm just going to buy sweetener at the grocery store to have with me. Nope, they didn't have it either. They had stevia, which tastes like ass. I don't know if you've ever had stevia. But
come on, really?
And saccharin. That was it.
Method.
Again, no aspartame, no Splenda.
The most popular sweetener of 1973.
Yeah. Oh, it tastes like medicine.
So I just basically had to just have sparkling water everywhere, which is like one of my
defaults.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember when I quit drinking Coke like less than a year ago, but I was a red can, you know, Coke classic kind of person my whole life, like in a bad way. And so that was always so comforting when I would travel internationally. It's like, it doesn't matter where you go on this planet, Coca-Cola has planted their flag.
Although it's bottled locally, so it tastes a little different. But
it always tastes a bit different. Yeah,
I have to avoid caffeine, so I couldn't have any of it. And then the other thing is that they're really big into the whole natural GMO free thing. It's like probably worse, Kara, than California.
I mean, that's crazy. What?
Really bad. Yeah. The bio market, you know, everything. That's why I think that's why they don't have aspartame or anything like that there. It's just that's their thing. Mm. All of Europe is that way. They're just completely crazy, anti-GMO, all that stuff. They just have a very different cultural concept of food. You know what I mean? Like the whole food is this natural breathing thing. And you can't do anything artificial to it or whatever. That's just embedded in the culture.
Yeah.
So was very much in evidence. All the menus had this crazy, like literally like 20, 30 different codes for everything it has in it. Like every possible kind of allergy was coded on which I guess is a good thing. But it was
that's not
way
bad.
More than anything I've seen in the United States. Like in the United States, it's like, peanuts and a couple few other things.
And some calories.
In certain parts. Or is that now nationwide?
There was literally a key with like 25 different things that they would indicate in the menu.
Oh, that's helpful.
Yeah.
But oh my God, the pastries.
Yeah, the pastries were incredible.
Tell me about one.
I mean, you know. So the most famous one that we went to was this the soccer tort. Have you ever heard of that, Kara?
Yes.
The soccer tort when you were there?
I think so. Yeah. It's kind of big, right?
It's the most chocolate cake you'll ever have in your life.
And do they sell them in like a tin can?
This was you go there's a hotel that I guess invented this thing and
we went to the hotel and sat. It's like there's glass windows kind of like around half of it. Yes, and it's in a little square. I remember
so,
that.
Yeah, but so we went there. We getting got the context. This, the hotel invented what?
A cake.
It's like a chocolate cake. Like, it's a tort. And it's SACHER soccer. That's the name of the hotel. So it's the soccer tort, and it's famous for that. And so we got it, and it was like really delicious chocolate. Of course, their chocolate is awesome.
Yeah, and I think you can buy them to take home with you, and they're like in a big metal tin.
But that wasn't even the best dessert I had there. I mean, that was, you know, there's like, I mean, I had to keep it under control. But just everything was fantastic. It was, they definitely know what they're doing there.
I could eat spetzel and schnitzel and whipped potatoes and sausage every day of my life, and then my heart would explode.
All right, well, Bob, get us started with a forgotten superhero of science.
Yes, for this week's superhero of science, I'm covering Beatrice Schilling, 1909 to 1990. She was an engineer who fixed the carburetor on the Spitfire's Merlin engines, allowing them to dive without fear of stalling during aerial combat. Schilling grew up tinkering with motorcycles and dreaming of being an engineer one day. That day pretty much came in 1932. She got a Master of Science in Mechanical Engineering, and within a few years, she started working for the business or company that she'd be with until retirement. She was the scientific officer, or as I'd like to call it, the science officer, of the Royal Aircraft Establishment, RAE, which basically did the R&D for the Royal Air Force. Her claim to fame is the unfortunately nicknamed Miss Schilling's Orifice.
What?
Yeah, I know. Okay. It's not pleasant, but the people that called it that was, you know, it was done with affection, but maybe they didn't interpret it the way we do now. But the bottom line, so this basically fixed a problem with the Rolls-Royce Merlin engine. It's a British 27-liter liquid-cooled V12 piston aero engine, one of the most successful aircraft engines during World War II. But it had a problem early on, and it was discovered during some battles like the Battle of Britain. RAF pilots realized that when they started a nosedive, the negative G-forces would basically flood the carburetor, causing a stall. Not fun in aerial combat. That must have been scary as hell. I think it probably caused some deaths too, right? You go in a dive and your engine stalls. I mean,
not a good thing.
Not a good thing. Unfortunately, the fuel injected German planes did not stall. So all they really had to do to get away, if they were in like dire straits, all they had to do was do a nice dive and they could escape the RAF pilots. So that must have been annoying and as frustrating as hell. So Schilling fixed this very easily with what's technically called an RAE restrictor, which was essentially a disc that was fit on the carburetor that prevented flooding. So this worked great for quick dives for years until a permanent solution was created, namely a pressurized carburetor. That really solved the problem. But for at least a few years that they used this and it worked for many, many different dive scenarios. Not long extended dives, but for quick dives, it was great. It's funny. I like to imagine that very first RAF pilot with her restrictor on his carburetor. I bet he was just waiting for the enemy to dive so that he could freak them out and follow them down that dive.
Yeah, that poor German pilot was like, all you got to do is do a nosedive and he won't follow you. Psych!
So all of that thanks to Schilling. So remember Beatrice Schilling. Mention her to your friends, perhaps when discussing upper explosive limits or perhaps the dreaded hydrolock.
The hydrolock. I like nice. That.
All right. Thanks, Bob. Kara, tell us about deep brain stimulation.
I like this stuff.
You like this stuff?
Yes, I like deep brain stimulation. Get your fingers way down deep inside and squiggle them around.
I was going to say, have you ever been stimulated deep in your brain? It's pretty invasive up
till
now.
What? Magnetic fields?
No, well, that's not considered deep brain.
Oh, it's not. That's the brain crust and upper mantle. What is what?
So, be careful what you order, Bob.
So let's talk about this a little bit. There are a bunch of different ways to stimulate the brain. We've known about many for many years. A nice list here. There's transcranial magnetic stimulation, but of course that's transcranial. It's across the cranius, cranium, cranius.
The cranius.
There's, that was a very word. It's a very cromulent word, you guys. Okay,
I like it. I like
recovery.
Yes, thank you. There's transcranial direct current stimulation, and I've done TMS and TDCS before, so I can tell you a little bit about my experience with that. But both of those are on the outside of the brain, and they go across the cranium. There's magnetic seizure therapy, there's vagus nerve stimulation, and of course, there's deep brain stimulation, which we often think about and hear about as a treatment for example, for Parkinson's disease, but it's invasive, right? Deep brain stimulation requires that you actually go into the brain and place electrodes. There's usually a learning period around that. You know, the neurosurgeons and the neuroscientists, there's usually a neuroscientist in the room who has been working on the map. They're able to find the right place to place the electrodes by switching it on and off during the awake surgery. But then afterward, there's a long training period to really learn exactly how much stimulation is the right amount of stimulation and how well it works. So obviously, there are a lot of options available for different uses. But there's a new paper that came out in Cell, and it was written by Nir Grossman and his colleagues from the lab of Edward Boyden at MIT. And they developed a new system where they do non-invasive deep brain stimulation. So they basically have two scalp electrodes, which you have in TDCS, for example, transcranial direct current stimulation. Whereas in TDCS, you have an anode and a cathode, and you basically just close a circuit. And so the electrical pulse goes all the way through. It finds the path of least resistance between the anode and the cathode. This is a completely different thing. Basically, both fields put out a frequency, or both electrodes put out a frequency field, but they're tuned slightly differently. So let's say one electrode is putting out 2 kilohertz and the other electrode is putting out 2.01 kilohertz. Now, the kilohertz range is way too high to have a neuronal effect, but where they overlap, they actually form an interference pattern, and that interference pattern is way lower, like in the hertz range, like it could be 5-10 hertz. And that interference pattern is actually what has been shown in these lab studies with mice to have an effect on neural activity, and it has an effect deep below the cortex. So they have done studies on mice looking, for example, at the hippocampus, and they've been able to show that hippocampal neurons are stimulated while cortical neurons are quiet using this deep brain stimulation device that they're calling temporally interfering electric fields or temporal interference stimulation. Now, they've only done this in mice, and what would be the biggest, I wonder if this will work in humans. What do you guys think?
Do it in monkeys.
Yeah, we got to do it in monkeys first. Yeah. But why do you, the authors are saying they think there's no problem this is going to work in humans. And they're even, all of the images in their paper are of human brains, which is interesting because even they're doing use it mouse in mice. Brains. Yeah. But what's the biggest difference? There are a lot of differences. Yes, of course. Yeah.
The depth.
Human brains are big. And so the difference between the cortex and the hippocampus is a way bigger area that you have to traverse. Yeah. Like in a mouse brain, the hippocampus was only 3 millimeters away from the electrodes. You know, it's like mouse brains are small. But the cool thing about this is that it's actually apparently what they say or what they call steerable, meaning that by changing the voltages, they're able to pinpoint different areas within the brain. Now, the edges aren't that clean. So that's obviously something to take into consideration. Nearby structures will probably still be stimulated, but they're wondering if adding more electrodes and being able to pinpoint based on kind of triangulating those electrodes wouldn't give more pinpointed stimulation. Now, there was a great write-up on this by Neuroskeptic, who writes for Discover, for one of the blogs on Discover. And Neuroskeptic is very skeptical. Even though he says it's cliche, he thinks this could be like one of the sort of biggest achievements in neuroscience if it really does pan out. This could change a lot if it works. He also did a really good job to point out that the authors in the paper kind of wrote it up as if they were the first people to ever think of this protocol, and they were the first people to ever think of kind of the physics and the geometry of doing it this way. But apparently interferential stimulation was first proposed by Soviet scientists in the 1960s, and it's actually an established usage in electrotherapy. So doing this similar thing where you have the two electric fields that overlap and form an interference pattern is used quite often on the nerves to treat pain. But it does seem to be the case that these authors were the first people to ever do this in lab and publish having done this on the brain, like going through the skull and scalp and going deep into the brain. So super interesting. I think it has a lot of promise. I'm really excited to see it done in humans. And the good news is human trials on something like this are probably going to be significantly easier to start undertaking. Because even though some authors, I actually found an interesting paper in Frontiers in Systems Neuroscience by a couple of UK and Italian authors who think that we should be changing the medical definition of invasive versus non-invasive because of these new tools like brain stimulation and optogenetics, where just because you don't make an incision doesn't mean that you can't do potential harm and doesn't mean that the side effects can't be pretty significant. So,
well, I've heard the term semi-invasive applied to situations like that.
Where
you might not be cutting into the body, but you are affecting stuff, you know, directly. So, I think that's a reasonable term to use, a semi-invasive procedure.
Absolutely. But I still think, and correct me if you think I'm wrong, Steve, research on these kind of semi-invasive tools like brain stimulation, probably the protocols are easier to dive into sooner on human subjects because we already do TDCS. We already have an established track record with deep brain stimulation and with transcranial magnetic knockout studies and things like that. So,
yeah, but anything new like this, any device, you're going to have to get FDA approval for research even.
Yeah.
And they just want to make sure that you're not going to fry people's brains, right? You know, they just want to make sure that they're safe.
Absolutely.
So you will have to go through that step. To do it on people, yeah.
And you're probably right. Try it on primates or cats or dogs or any other research animals that have larger brains.
Yeah, you got to get closer to us in size. Like, for example, one of the speculations here is that if you scale this up to human size, you're going to be using currents that may not be tolerable.
Exactly.
It's going to be stimulating a little bit too strongly there. So, yeah, it's very intriguing, but wow, is there a big difference between mouse brains and people brains? And you just can't say. I get more interested in this kind of thing when they're doing it on monkeys because
absolutely
you're getting close there.
Did they mention anything like what would be an amazing outcome for this?
Well, an amazing outcome would be to be able to do this, for example, on a Parkinson's patient, and they would never have to have surgery.
Okay, I get it.
Yeah, it could also be used to stop a seizure in progress.
Yeah, that's true. Oh, that would be amazing.
Theoretically, for migraines, imagine you have a migraine, slap an electrode on your temple and stop it. You know,
oh my God.
Without having to take medications. So that's all possible. And there are already devices, transcutaneous devices, that are approved, but still really in the early kind of stages for migraines.
And they just can't really get that deep. That's been the biggest problem. Because in order to go deep, the voltages end up being too high, like you said. And in this case, that might still be a problem. But, you know, we want these small, small voltages that are at the level that are going to affect the neurons, you know, inducing them to either fire or to not fire. But in order to get, you know, it decays. So in order to get that deep, often we're talking about electrodes that are right on your skull. And I remember when I did just transcranial direct current stimulation, it feels prickly, like it feels hot on your head. Yeah. And that was under a research protocol with an FDA approved device in a research hospital. People doing this at home, like, they can hurt themselves. And I've seen DIY examples. We did a whole...
Oh, yeah. We can do do-it-yourself brain stimulation.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Part of the problem, the big problem is the skull. The skull itself dramatically attenuates any electrical activity.
Damn skull.
The skull, there's fat. You have so much fat around your head, and you have fluid around your brain.
Wait, you saying that I'm a fathead?
You're a fathead.
So imagine this, Kara. I don't know if this will ever happen, but imagine if you just like drill two small holes through your skull to make portals.
Trepanation?
Yeah.
That you could then put the devices over the portals so that you could stimulate much lower, you know, energy and still get the signal down deep into the brain.
Babies live for months that way, but you know their skull isn't fused.
Yeah, it's not a problem.
Yeah, no. And lab animals, a common protocol in lab animals when you want to be able to see inside the brain is to remove part of the skull and surgically remove part of the skull and put a clear window in. Yeah, and then look through that window. Yeah.
Bob, don't get any ideas.
Yeah, and Jay, when you do that, you can see the brain pulsating.
No, it doesn't.
That's right.
No, I decided that the brain does not do that.
You decided. Yep, you told science it was wrong.
Yes, it is.
The brain
wrong.
Never moves, right, Jay?
All right, Jay.
What?
Jay, tell me this. Should you exercise on a full stomach or an empty stomach?
Interesting.
That's a great question, Steve. And science has actually delivered a pretty damn good answer. But pseudoscience has also delivered an answer.
Oh, which one is correct?
Yeah,
So you guys may you might have heard.
I need
about
confirmation bias here, Jay. I've got to make sure I've been doing it right this whole time.
Let me help shed a little bit of skeptical light on this question. So you have definitely heard, especially the people on this show, you've heard about this idea to maximize fat burning. You should fast before you exercise. I've heard that. You know, for the 20 years, I've heard people talking about that in all the gyms I've been to. Now, the idea here is, since your body is running on stored energy, which is your fat, that while you exercise, you will increase your fat burning instead of burning the energy from the glucose that's in your blood from a recent meal. So the concept...
Don't you need to have enough sugar, like, available to your brain so you don't lose consciousness or throw up or...
Yeah, we're not talking about days of fasting. We're talking about hours of fasting.
Just wake up in the morning and go work out before you eat breakfast. I see.
Overnight fasting. Yep.
Don't exercise after a meal is really what they're saying.
Yeah, like, look at it like this. The idea here is that once you eat, your body's breaking down and using the food for fuel for your entire body. Fat burning supposedly ends once you eat something and your blood sugar levels go up. So the you eat food, your blood sugar levels go up very quickly from eating food. And, you know, on the surface, this idea, you know, it seems relatively cromulent. Okay, so if I don't eat and I don't have that sugar coursing through my veins, then my body is going to turn to my fat stores for energy. That's the base concept here. Now, people who adhere to this practice, they call it a fasted exercise. And that means, of course, that you're working out while, quote unquote, fasting. Okay.
Oh, I thought they went faster than normal. Okay. Gotcha. Thank you.
Fasted exercise. Yeah. I work out in 30 seconds. Name that workout. So what does the latest research have to say about this? The reality is, of course, more complicated than the simple view that I just painted above about fasted exercise. So an experiment was done in 2014 that I referenced that shed some specific light on this exact thing. So they tested people with a fasted workout versus a control group who ate before the workout. So they used 20 women. They split the women into two different groups, one for the fasted workout and one for the fed workout. The training was 1 hour of a steady state aerobic exercise 3 days a week, and all the test subjects were given a customized dietary plan that would give them a caloric deficit, meaning that they were on target to lose weight no matter what they did. The food intake of those tested were monitored as well to make sure that they were eating the proper diet that they were given, and this was monitored on a regular basis. Now, those who were in the fasted group exercised in the morning after they, you know, right after they got up, after and not eating all night and not eating anything after they woke up, right? So they get up and they exercise on an empty stomach. They were given a meal shake right after the exercise, which lasted 1 hour. The other group was given a meal shake right before the exercise. The research showed that it didn't matter when the calories were consumed. Exercising after you had a meal or not made no difference.
Ooh.
Yep. In fact, there's a risk to fasting before exercise because you're liable to burn more muscle for energy than if you're fed before the exercise. Your body will burn muscle before it decides to burn fat, or, you know, there's a percentage of muscle that'll get burned over fat if you're suffering from a lack of energy, a lack of actual glucose in your blood. Yeah.
Yeah, for a lack of glucose specifically, because your brain needs glucose. Your brain, you know, really can't use fat as energy. It needs glucose. Mm-hmm. And if it starts to get too low and you don't have the stores because you're humans can't make sugar. You know,
but gluconeogenesis or something?
Yeah, we don't
like
do that.
That,
but we don't do that. Like animals that hibernate could do that. They could make sugar out of fat, but we can't do that. So we make the next best thing, which is ketones.
And that's made
from protein. So that's why you start to build, you burn muscle to make the ketones, because that's the fast energy like sugar. But you don't want to do that. You might have heard that ketosis, like that's the whole point of a low carb diet is to induce ketosis. It's all bullshit. So this is a persistent myth, this notion that you should fast before you work out because you want to burn fat. It's crap. It doesn't matter when you consume your calories. It doesn't matter when you consume your calories. The only thing that matters is how many calories you burn. Because you eat and how many you burn. Because if you think about it, let's say you eat a meal, you have the glucose, you have the nutrients from the meal that you eat, then you burn them all off from exercise, right? Then what are you going to be using for energy over the next few hours until your next meal? You're still going to be burning your fat stores.
Yeah.
Right? So it doesn't make any conceptual sense, not even any basic common sense. When you think about it all the way through, it's really in it. And the research shows, yep, it should be nonsense. And it in fact is nonsense. And in fact, if anything, it's a net negative because you're more likely to burn your muscle rather than just use the glucose that you eat and then use your fat stores for homeostasis.
Yeah, people often don't think of catabolism, right? Yeah. Our metabolisms, like catabolism is breaking things down for energy, anabolism is building up, but we don't think that catabolism happens all the time, whether we're, you know, sitting on the couch or it obviously happens to a bigger extent when we're exercising, but it requires energy to be alive, you know? And so obviously just to get through the day, we have to have that fuel. And I think the point that you made about needing glucose for your brain is so important, because the other two risks that are sort of related to, Jay, what you said, if you don't have any glucose stores, you could lose consciousness while you're exercising. Yeah. Like you can get really sick if there's not enough glucose getting to your brain. But second to that, if you do start breaking down that muscle and you start doing it really rapidly, that can also lead to rhabdomyolysis, which is secondary, I think, a lot of times to, like, you hear about it being correlated with CrossFit and with people who push their bodies way too hard. I have a friend who actually got rhabdo, and she's
what
a physician. It's gross.
Just muscle breakdown.
Yeah, it's when your muscles physically break down and you don't really have the mechanism to be able to dispose of that much myoglobin. You end up urinating a lot of myoglobin out. Like, the biggest thing that you notice when you have rhabdo is they say Coca-Cola colored urine. Like, that's a bad sign.
Oh my God.
And compartment syndrome, where you'll just start to have fluid building up in certain compartments, like your fingers might just start build up fluid, or your arm might to start building up
water
fluid. Yeah, but it actually can cut off some of the blood flow to those areas. And the treatment rhabdo is aggressive rehydration. So you have to go into the hospital and get like an insane saline drip. Like my friend who, again, she's a physician. So, you know, it's one of those things where she's like, I think I might have rhabdo. No, I'm being overly obsessive. And then she went to the doctor and the doctor was like, holy shit, you have rhabdo. Like we need to put you on a drip.
Kara, how long does it take to get, rid of rhabdo?
Depends on the number. But the other thing is, Jay, is that, when you're working out, you want the workout itself to be optimal, right? Who the hell wants to like be, starved while you're working out? You want your body to have, that's when you need all your calories and nutrients, right?
So oh, that's it doesn't even make sense. Yeah.
You're probably going to do a better workout if you are, I don't like to work out on a full stomach. I mean, I don't want to like go right from a table to an exercise.
I want to puke.
Right. But there's a happy medium in there where you're not fasting, but there's not food in your stomach. And it has to be mentioned, be well hydrated. Absolutely hydrate. Yeah. And then you'll actually get a safer, better, exercise in that situation and healthier.
Don't worry about
when you consume your calories. It's the total amount that matters. And you should spread them out throughout the day, again, just to maintain sort of a steady state of blood sugar, et cetera. You want to avoid the wild fluctuations in your blood sugar. One good way to have your blood sugar crash is to fast and then work out, right? That's like the exact thing you shouldn't do.
Oh, yeah. Can you imagine somebody with diabetes doing that?
Yeah. It's a big
exercise is very good for diabetics in general. So almost any exercise they do is going to be good for them. But yeah,
that's good.
It's very important to maintain that steady state, not to have wild fluctuations.
Anything that steers you away from staying well hydrated and having a nice, regular, balanced meal or meal plan, right? Eat three meals a day, have variety in your diet, eat a lot of green leafy vegetables, have some lean protein. You have that good mix. Everything you do is going to be fine. Right?
You had said, you want to spread it out. And that's like for your metabolism. You want to spread out the number of calories that you consume in the day. But you hear a lot of times that you shouldn't eat high caloric things before you go to sleep.
That's also a myth.
Interesting.
Doesn't matter. It doesn't matter when you consume your calories.
Nice.
Well, right. I mean, but there are other things to consider, such as the effects of heartburn.
It might interfere with your sleep. I tell people don't eat right before you get bed. That's not for weight management.
No,
that's
not for
just
weight
for your sleep quality. You don't want to be digesting food or get reflux
I hate that.
So no, yeah, and also sometimes people have to get up in the middle of the night to pee. It's like, well, don't drink right before you go to bed. Give yourself a couple of hours, empty your bladder. So so that's a sleep hygiene, but not has nothing to do with your body weight though. But that is a persistent myth. But just
interesting. Again, it's a very persistent myth.
Bottom line, doesn't matter when you consume your calories.
She was.
Evan.
Yeah.
So some people think that we're in the middle of a sixth extinction right now.
A lot of people do.
But not everybody believes that.
Nope, not everyone. This was a article I read written by Peter Brannon at The Atlantic. And he did a nice interview with a gentleman named Doug Irwin, who's a paleontologist for the Smithsonian Institution. And this is kind of an aside. I wanted to bring this up. He's rumored to have served as a mass extinction consultant to Cormac McCarthy's post-apocalyptic book called The Road. I don't know if any of you have read that. I know it from the movie.
I saw the movie.
That's one of the hardest movies I've ever seen in my life. It is a gut punch, that movie. And he also, Cormac McCarthy also wrote No Country for Old Men.
That was a great movie.
So yeah, another great movie. So just a little aside there. But in any case, Doug Irwin, paleontologist. And according to Irwin, we are not in the sixth extinction yet.
Hmm.
All right. And he said specifically in this interview, and I'll quote him, people who claim we're in the sixth mass extinction don't understand enough about mass extinctions to understand the logical flaw in their argument. To a certain extent, they're claiming it as a way of frightening people into action, when in fact, if it's actually true that we're in a sixth mass extinction, then there's no point in conservation biology. What he's basically saying is that once you're over the line and you've declared it, it's too late anyways. There's nothing you can do. All the conservation in the world will not stop it. It's a cascade effect. He says that it's a network collapse problem, like a power grid. Or, you know, he earlier in the interview, he talked about the 2003 power outage that took place in the Northeast. And he's talked about how that sort of cascaded into this larger, larger problem. He said that's kind of what happens with the with these events, and nothing's going to stop it. He says there are physicists studying it who don't care about power grids or ecosystems. They care about math. So the secret about power grids is that nobody actually knows how they work. And that's the exact same problem you have in ecosystems. He goes on to say, I think that if we keep things up long enough, we'll get to a mass extinction, but we're not in a mass extinction yet. And I think that it's an optimistic discovery because that means we actually do have time to avoid Armageddon.
Yeah, so I think he's playing with definition there. And his point is taken. He has a point. Is that in the past, the first five mass extinctions involved ecosystem collapse at some level, and we're not at that point yet. But that doesn't mean that there isn't accelerated extinction going on right now. By some estimates, species are going extinct 5 to 6 times the background rate, because species are always going extinct. But
amphibians are going extinct at like something crazy, like 35,000 times the background rate. Like there are certain really extreme examples of that.
But here's the other thing is
How do you determine background rate?
You calculate how often do species go extinct? Like how long do they survive? How many species are there in the world? Therefore, there should be this number of extinctions per year, just as the background rate of extinctions. And yet there are more than that. But we don't really know how many. We don't know how many extinctions there are every year because we don't have a survey of all the animals, so it's estimated, and the estimates are all in dispute because a lot of assumptions.
That's what I found. What I found. For example, there was a paper published in the journal Nature 2011 and they said that over the last 500 years there have been just 875 confirmed extinctions.
Yeah, but that's confirmed. That's at the maximally conservative end where, like, we've gone decades without detecting any of these animals.
Yeah. It doesn't even account for things that are, like, violently threatened.
Right. And plus, we only know of maybe 1/10 of the species that actually exist on the entire planet to begin with. We don't know how many are going extinct. We haven't identified them all by any stretch.
Also, Evan, like, how does he define? I know that we have a proper definition for the previous five mass extinctions, but didn't those extinctions occur over hundreds of thousands, even millions of years? And we're looking at records of hundreds of years when we're talking about this quote unquote sixth. It just seems like the boundaries are fuzzier than he's making them out to be.
When he was talking about it in the interview, he was talking about it in the context that if you want to say that the mass extinction is currently underway, then you can go back tens of thousands of years and say that that's where it started, basically with, you know, human civilization. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And 50,000 years ago. So essentially you can tie it back to that because once that occurred, it really changed the whole game of the planet.
Yeah, so, massively.
And you said he says that when you take it into a scale like that, that that is more in line with how the rapid decline of the species that were lost in the other mass extinctions that took place way back many, many, many years ago.
Isn't that how most people who talk about the sixth extinction, they talk about it having correlated with human beings coming into play?
Oh, yeah, there's no question.
Absolutely.
Yeah. It's also, so he studies mass extinctions, but he's looking back at completed extinction events. And we're talking about, are we in the middle of one?
Or even at the beginning.
At the very beginning.
You can't apply
the
same criteria because we're not saying that one has happened. We're saying, is one in progress? Of course, we haven't tipped over to it being completed yet. That's the whole point of saying we're in the middle of it. But let me make just a couple other points. I have read a lot about this as well. So one point is that in trying to estimate more accurately the number of species that has gone extinct, what some researchers have found is that because some of the estimates are based upon habitat loss, but actually what happens when habitat is lost is that this species will migrate to the most similar habitat they could find. So what you end up happening, even when a species has lost 90% of its habitat, they just crowd into the last 10%. And so what they found was that there are far more species in far smaller habitats than there were previously. And so, those species may not have gone extinct, But damn, are they under stress, because now they're all crowded together in whatever little, you know, bit of land is left to them. The second thing is that when a species number is reduced below 2,000, that's a bottleneck. The probability that they will go extinct over the next 1,000 years approaches 100%. It's not 100%. Yes, you can survive the bottleneck, but it gets like it's upwards of 90%. And so that's why, again, people who think that we are in the middle of a mass extinction is because there not only have a lot of species already gone extinct way above the background rate, but because of habitat loss and species reduction, there are tons of species that almost certainly will go extinct in the next 100 to 1,000 years. And it may already be too late, unless we begin to take extreme actions to preserve them, to preserve habitat, to preserve species, you know, to preserve genetic diversity. Just it's hard. Yep. It's because it takes millions of years to generate genetic diversity, and you can, once you lose it, you know it's gone.
And that's like, we're not even accounting for that, for example. Like the puma in California, the puma is not a threatened species. Like, we know that, or I don't know if it is, but it's definitely not like on the verge of extinction. That said, it's incredibly inbred. Like, it's not a diverse species anymore, just like the Florida panther. And that's a huge problem, but it probably doesn't even show up on these surveys when we're talking about whether or not this is a mass extinction. How many places has biodiversity gone down the toilet, but the animals aren't technically yet extinct?
Yeah, that's my point. Yeah. So unless we take measures to reverse this trend, it's clear from everything we know, you know, that, yeah, that there's a lot of species not only have already gone extinct, but will go extinct.
Yeah, they're walking extinct.
They're the walking extinct. There's no way that we could maintain the biodiversity. Half the land on the earth is farmland now. Half, right? We've mentioned that multiple times on the show before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just recently.
There's massive habitat loss. Just there's no way we're going to maintain the biodiversity with that. Yeah, unfortunately, I think there's no way. I think there's no way to avoid a major extinction. All we could do now is try to minimize it.
So therefore, is the question, are we in it or are we on the cusp of it? Is it a moot point? Yeah, is it really a senseless
definition? Kind of it's semantics. It is what it is. I think, you know, he's saying if you define it as ecosystem collapse, it hasn't happened yet. Okay, fine. But we are, by every indicator, is that we're in the middle of one. All right. So I know we've been talking a lot recently about a lot of paleontological stuff, but there's just been so many cool discoveries recently. You know, I don't know why they're all happening at once. So recently, get this, in northern Africa, so this is like north of the Sahara, basically in Morocco. There was a find with some human remains that they thought, maybe these are Neanderthal, maybe, you know, they're like 40,000 years old, or not really. They couldn't date them directly because they weren't found in material that can be dated very well. But then they found some further, like another layer there, like some further specimens that was in situ, meaning that it was embedded in material and that material could be dated. And they had with further specimens. Now they have specimens from at least five individuals, all from the same time period. And they were able to date it. And they came up with two very interesting bits of information, especially when you combine them together. One is that these specimens are fully modern Homo sapiens.
Okay.
And two is that they're at least 300,000 years old.
300,000?
Yeah, which pushes back the origin of Homo sapiens 100,000 years.
100, damn.
That's not and a also, small amount. Yeah.
Out of Africa, right?
Or, well, no, it's not Morocco.
Technically out of Africa. Yeah, it is Morocco.
It's not sub-Saharan Africa, which is where... So previously it was thought that our species evolved in sub-Saharan Africa maybe 200,000 years ago. And now we find the specimens in Morocco 300,000 to 350,000 at the high end, 1,000 years ago. So as we've said previously, this is a jigsaw puzzle where every time we find a new piece, we realize that the puzzle is bigger than we thought and more complicated than we thought. So now, if this is true, so again, always this has to really go through the meat grinder of peer review and people have got to question it and make sure. But it's, you know, it sounds pretty solid, but we'll see. This means that, you know, again, humans evolved earlier than we thought. But not only that, they may have been far ranging. Humans may have ranged all over Africa, not just limited to sub-Saharan Africa.
Right, right. That's something right there. Just that alone is pretty pretty different than what I've been hearing.
This would have made
years.
A good science fiction, Steve. You might have gotten me on this one.
Yeah, but it was too wide, too widely reported, I thought. But Jean-Jacques Hublin from the Max Planck Institute for Evolutionary Anthropology in Leipzig made the recent discovery and analysis. And he said, yeah, this is a huge finding. And it has, you know, significant implications for how we figure, like, what evolved from what. If you remember, we were talking about Homo naledi, recently, which is the other, that was a science fiction. There's some information about Homo naledi. They found more specimens. They were able to date them, found that they were actually more recent than we had thought, because they had some ancient, more primitive features relative. When we say that, we always mean relatively, you know, on the, if you're looking at the line that led to Homo sapiens, you know, relatively modern or primitive on that line. It's always a relative statement. Not that there's something inherently primitive or advanced, you know what I mean? But anyway, so what this means is that we don't know how to connect the lines yet. We don't have enough specimens to know what evolved from what when. We're just filling in the space, you know, between chimpanzees and humans, and there's lots of branching going on. The other thing is that the concept of species, I think now that we are sort of delving down deep into the details of this, you know, eight million years of evolution from the last common ancestor with chimps to ourselves, to modern humans, that the concept of species is just too fuzzy to think about this in terms of species. You know what I mean? I think that we have to really think about the fact that there were just populations spread throughout Africa, and those populations were only like metastable collections of features of genes, but, you know, we only can infer those genes through the morphology we could see in the fossils. And that also they're interbreeding. Remember, don't forget about that. This is like, these are all close enough together that there's probably a lot of hanky-panky going on. So the idea of trying to imagine the evolution of humans from the last common ancestor with chimps as, you know, species A gave rise to species B, gave rise to species C, is just not going to work. It's just, that's not the way it happened.
It's not linear at all.
Yeah. It's not only is it not linear, but I mean, even just the very concept of species A and species B is just too fuzzy. It's just, I don't think that we can really break it down that way. You have subtypes. Like even this species, it's Homo sapiens. It's our species, but it's ancient Homo sapiens. So it has some features, like it has prominent eyebrows, more eye ridges, more so than you or I, for example, and the slightly smaller brain case. So it's still within the range of Homo sapiens, but we could tell it's not a modern day Homo sapiens.
So it's like a 0.98 Homo sapiens.
Yeah, whatever. Scenario, yeah, yeah. Right? So what does that mean? So is that just because it was 300,000 years ago, or is that because there's other species mixed in there? And, you know, who knows? It's very, very complicated, but.
That's a mind blower. That just the past 2 minutes, like, holy crap.
Hominids were a successful, widespread species in Africa and spreading out of Africa. The fact it's just an accident of evolutionary history that there's just one tiny little branch left, and not only that, but fairly recently we passed through bottlenecks. So, like 200,000 years ago, there was a pretty significant bottleneck.
Yeah, how low did we get? Was it like 2000?
Again, probably like 2000. Yeah, right? right at the cusp there. Yeah. Right at the
and
cusp
that,
of extinction.
That little filter we went through, that supremely diminished our diversity. We would see if it weren't for that bottleneck, we would see, I would just love to think sometimes what kind of diversity we would see.
Just think of other animals, like elephants, right? Like there's African and Indian elephants. There's four species of zebra that are actual different species, you know.
There's actually a third species of elephant, though, too. They found.
Oh, yeah, I know. They genetically thought it was divided into two, but.
Well, look at dogs.
If only dachshunds survived.
Right.
Then that's what dogs would be. They would be dachshunds. Right. And all that genetic diversity would be lost. So, yeah, we're like the dachshunds of the hominids. We're just the ones that survived.
Could we be the long-haired dachshund? I like those.
Maybe, yeah, with the long-haired miniature dachshund.
They're so cute.
Watching this story unfold with fascination, it just keeps getting more interesting. And it also seems like just the quality and number of fossils that we're finding now is just so much better. You know, like we're finding these sites with multiple specimens and like full skulls and really good specimens.
And that's just dumb luck, right? It's not even about skills, I don't think. It's just
I don't think it's just skill in knowing where to look.
Yeah, I think we're just getting better at looking, and we have more people doing it or whatever. I think, I don't think it's just luck. I think we know the scientists are getting better at ferreting these things out. It's partly luck, absolutely. Like any time you're looking for stuff, but yeah, hopefully there's more to come, you know? Who knows what wacky stuff there is out there for us to find? You know, entire new species that we, like, for example, we talked about even the Gracopithecus, where there was, you know,
I don't think so.
Yeah, the maybe the closest common ancestor to humans and chimps was actually outside of Africa, although it was at a time when the Mediterranean was probably walkable, you know? All right, Bob, tell us about how stars are born.
So astronomers have concluded that most, if not all, lower mass stars start off as binaries. That means that our sun probably had a companion star long ago that is now long gone and among all the other stars in our stellar neighborhood. Now we've known for a long time, right, that there's plenty of multiple star systems out there. But this is the first time that there's some solid data to support the idea that essentially all of sun-like stars were born in multiples. Now, they came to this conclusion after looking at the Perseus molecular cloud 600 light-years away at 50 light-years long. So some of you might be thinking, all right, what's a molecular cloud? Yeah, it's kind of like, well, all right, I know what a cloud is. I know what molecules are, but what's going on with this in space?
Clouds are already made of molecules, right?
Right. A molecular cloud is most often a cloud of hydrogen, probably not too easy, not too hard to figure out. But what kind of hydrogen? There's three natural isotopes of hydrogen, and two of them are stable. So if you look around the universe, you're going to find three natural isotopes. Two of them are going to last for a long time. The other one is not. So let's start with hydrogen 3. That's called tritium. That's one proton and two neutrons, but it's radioactive. It's got a half-life of 12.3 years, not long. So that's not stable. Hydrogen 2 is deuterium. That's one proton, one neutron, but it's not the most common type of hydrogen. The most common is hydrogen 1. That's one proton, and that's it. One proton and an electron. No neutrons at all. Now, I didn't know this, and I kind of love this. What do you call that? Hydrogen 2 is deuterium. Hydrogen 3 is tritium. What's hydrogen 1?
Hydrogen.
Well, everybody, right. Everybody just calls it hydrogen. But it had a name that's not used very much, and it was called protium. P-R-O-T-I-U-M. Protium. And I kind of love that word. I'm going to start using that instead of hydrogen.
And no one will know what you're talking about.
Right, but they'll learn. So this is a molecular cloud then, though. So that means that two proteins have covalently bonded together to form molecular hydrogen. That's two protons and two electrons. So that's basically what this molecular cloud or these molecular clouds are made of. And that is also happens to be the primary form of hydrogen found in the universe. These molecular clouds are filled with gas and dust, which doesn't let visible light out or visible light through it. So they basically look like a dark void in space. They're actually really cool looking. Just do a Google image search. Some of them are actually beautiful. You see this weird void against this bright backdrop of stars because they basically, you know, they let the photons gather for a long period of time. So the background stars are really bright and you got this creepy kind of void in the background. It almost looks like a dark rift into an alternate universe, but that's a molecular cloud. So now these clouds are also called probably really importantly, stellar nurseries, because within them, they've got these egg-shaped cocoons, as some people refer to them, which are also called dense cores. And so these dense cores are sprinkled throughout the molecular cloud, and this is where the molecular cloud is dense enough to collapse into stars. If you looked at these molecular clouds with light telescopes, you're not going to see much. It's just a dark void. But radio telescopes, though, you can see what's going on, which is why these researchers used the Very Large Array, which is a collection of radio dishes in New Mexico. Now, using this array, they completed the very, very first full survey of all young stars in a molecular cloud. First time ever. Never been done to this extent before. They then did what I mentioned quite often in these types of news items. They combined that data set with another data set from another telescope, a different telescope, and this time it was the James Clerk Maxwell Telescope in Hawaii. So they take these two data sets, put them together, and they get lots of new information. So looking at the resulting detailed star information, what they then tried to explain it is, all right, how do these stars, how do they get to where they are? Why in this Perseus molecular cloud, why do these stars have, why are they arranged the way they are? Why are they separated by these specific distances? If they all came from the same cloud, why are they arranged in this particular way? So they ran these mathematical models, these simulations over and over and over to try to see what kind of models could replicate the observations that they were making. And they found the only model that replicated what they were seeing in the Perseus molecular cloud was if these low mass sun-like stars are born together. No other scenario kind of made that work. So first author Sarah Sadovoy said, based on our simple model, we say that nearly all stars form with a companion. The Perseus cloud is generally considered a typical low-mass star-forming region, but our model needs to be checked in other clouds. So yeah, they're going to have to run this on other clouds. But the Perseus cloud is fairly typical. It's not atypical. So it makes sense to be confident, at least, that once they start looking at other clouds, they may come to the very same conclusions. All right. So you've got these stars that are similar to the sun in mass, and they're born as binaries. And then what? What happens? Because we're not a binary anymore. What happened? So what they think happened was that either one of two things happens. Either they shrink, the bound stars shrink and form a tightly coupled, long lasting binary system. Right? You end up with binary stars that stay that way for billions of years, essentially, or the separation grows wider and wider until there's essentially no gravitational binds between the sibling stars, and they just go off on their own orbiting the galaxy by themselves, just like our sun. So that means that, if these guys are right, the sun at one point probably did have a companion star, maybe not a twin then, but it's probably long gone and just lost itself in among the thousands of stars in our stellar neighborhood. It could be, any of those stars.
And is the bottom line is that they think that that happens because the collapsing clouds are egg-shaped, and they're egg-shaped clouds are going to form the two foci and the two stars.
Yeah, I do remember that, but other websites I went to though didn't even discuss that too much. So okay. I mean, I guess it could. I like the idea of the foci. That's an interesting idea. That seems reasonable to me.
All right, Jay, who's that noisy time?
Okay, last week I played this noisy.
That's the android from Alien during his meltdown.
Yeah, it's very uncomfortable.
What he was babbling.
Yeah, it reminded me of that, Ev. I definitely thought about that. So that is that's a neural network learning speech. It examines speech that's put into it, and then it tries to mimic it. And it's the active process of it trying to learn human speech.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, very, very, very cool. I just can't help but think that someday we're going to be talking to androids or talking to synths without getting into the consciousness part of it, but they're going to perfectly sound human and look mostly human, and we're going to be talking to them as if they're real.
Sure.
So we had a winner, and a ton of people guessed 100% correctly, so anyone that sent in the correct guess, great job. The winner from last week, Jeremy Hamilton, said, I suspect that the most reason Who's That Noisy is the output of a neural network trained on a data set of someone counting.
I don't like it.
I know. I told you. I predicted that Kara was not going to like this
one. Yeah, it's creepy.
It's like, yeah, Uncanny
really?
Valley.
It's creepy. Yes. It's yeah. unnatural.
Uncanny Valley with voice
yeah.
awesome.
It's like, imagine, yeah.
Imagine like you're a scientist and it's 3 a.m. and you're walking into your lab. You can't sleep.
Oh, yeah.
And then,
okay.
And you hear one of the computers sussing okay. out reality, trying to figure it all out while the scientists are gone at night. Oh, yeah. There's a cool story in there somewhere. Anyway, I have a new Noisy this week. This Noisy was sent in by J.P. Leet. This one is cool. Take a listen. I have to play it again because it's probably the shortest Noisy I've ever done.
Yeah.
I agree,
that.
R2.
That was very R2. It was like a cute robot. Whatever that was, it is the sound of a cute robot.
Yes, and wait until you find out what it is. If you have a guess or you heard something really cool this week, email me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org.
Thank you, Jay. All right, Kara, what's the word?
Ooh, the word this week was actually recommended by a listener, Mark Leach. From the UK. Ooh, a chemistry professor, actually. He said, volatile has 3 uses, 2 correct and 1 wrong, due to the confusion of the 2 or more correct versions. 1, the boiling point of a liquid. Quote, ethanol is more volatile than water. And we will get to that in a minute. 2, economics. The markets were volatile today. 3, explosives, bombs, etc. The explosive was very volatile. Wrong, wrong, wrong. The explosive was not volatile. It was sensitive. Anyway, there's more to the story than this. Keep up the good work. And you're right, Mark. There are a lot of definitions of volatile, even more than those. The one that is necessary for science, we'll spend a little more time on. So let's talk about the other ones first. If I look at Merriam-Webster, which is kind of the standard for the American dictionary, characterized by or subject to rapid or unexpected change, that's kind of where that volatile market comes into place, or somebody has a volatile temper, or unable to hold the attention fixed because of an inherent lightness or fickleness of disposition. So somebody might be volatilely incapable of paying attention to something. They're too fickle or they're screwing off too much.
What was that?
What?
Exactly.
Oh. I get it.
Gotcha.
You always get me. Okay. Another definition, tending to erupt into violence. And I think that's where the misconstruing of the definition comes in, because, you know, there can be a volatile crowd that then erupts into violence, but explosives. So that crowd itself could be explosive, which is a synonym for volatile in that usage, but you wouldn't call an explosive a volatile explosive. Also easily aroused, but there continues to be this theme of lightheartedness and liveliness. But then here comes the scientific definition, readily vaporizable at a relatively low temperature, difficult to capture or hold permanently, which relates to that. And then a usage that we don't often think about, but is deep and old, flying or having the power to fly. So if you see something on the wing, you could call that volatile. And I'm about to tell you why. It's because the 1590s definition of volatile is either evaporating rapidly, which again, we will get to, or fine or light. And that comes from, you can break it down from the Middle French back to the Latin. It's a past participle of the word volare, which means to fly. And so the words that came out of that, like it being readily changing, fickle, and flighty, came about in the 1600s. But previous to that, actually in Middle English in the 1300s, volatiles were birds, butterflies, and other winged creatures. And so it really did kind of build upon that, which I think is just so lovely. But when we talk about something being volatile in the scientific sense, we're really talking about a substance that vaporizes readily. So volatility is the measure of how readily a substance goes from liquid to gas. Substances can also go straight from solid to vapor, which is actually called sublimation, but we still often use the term volatile to describe that substance. So a volatile substance has a high vapor pressure at a given temperature compared with a non-volatile compound. So a really good example of that is ethanol. You can put water in a glass and it slowly evaporates, but if you leave the cap off of your ethanol bottle, you're actually going to lose your ethanol pretty quickly.
Yeah, that's the sense in which I tend to use the word, you know, rapidly evaporating, you know, volatile liquid.
Yeah, in most scientific contexts, that's really what you're reading. That's what it means. So if you're reading something, a journal article, and they say this is a highly volatile compound, they're not saying it's going to explode.
Yeah.
They're saying it's going to evaporate or vaporize pretty readily. It's going to become gaseous. So keep that in mind. But that said, when we use it colloquially, we often are talking about things exploding, which is, you know, exploding in anger, exploding in violence, which is where I think a lot of the confusion comes in. But if you always remember that volatiles are things like birds and butterflies, they're on the wing, they're up in the air, then maybe it'll be easier to remember the actual definition, which is things that vaporize very readily.
Yeah. Cool.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you, Kara. One email today. This is just a quick follow-up on the science or fiction item from 1 or 2 weeks ago about CRISPR. Remember, you guys were all disappointed about the study showing greater than 1,500 off-target mutations in the CRISPR-Cas9 treated mice. All right, so this email comes from...
We didn't know, though. Go ahead.
From Mark Zeist from Switzerland, and Mark writes, last week in Science or Fiction, there was an item about greater than 1,500 off-target mutations in CRISPR-Cas9 treated mice. Science Friday podcast also covered this. It seems this finding is controversial. The statistics are shaky, and so is the editing technique used. And he goes on with some other details. But so here's the bottom line. So the study was looking at mice that had been treated with CRISPR, which is a gene editing technology that is very exciting, to treat blindness. And then the new study looked at those two mice that had been treated and tried to figure out how many they did it. They sequenced their entire genome and tried to figure out how many mutations they had as a result of the CRISPR, and they found what they claimed there were greater than 1,500 mutations off target, so not the intended genetic change, but unintended genetic changes. So if true, that would be very disappointing. It would mean that these are not as targeted or precise mechanisms as we thought. But Mark is correct in that, and I also wrote a follow-up on Neurologica about this, that there have been a lot of, you know, this is now the peer review, the post-publication peer review, where scientists pour over and go, I don't quite buy what you're selling here. They're basically saying that the techniques they use to estimate the number of mutations is not that reliable. And in fact, because keep in mind, they didn't do a pre-treatment and post-treatment comparison. They just looked at the mice who had been treated and then tried to infer how many mutations they had by comparing them to their litter mates. And what some of the critics pointed out, that you don't know how many of these mutations are just the natural variation.
Duh.
You know,
what the hell? Come on, that's a no-brainer. They weren't clones, so of course they're going to be different.
Right.
That wipes out any all of it. It's like, well, come back when you got something that's reasonable.
I don't think it wipes it out entirely. What it, to in my opinion, 98%. What this says is, okay, this is a legitimate concern, and maybe we need to look more carefully at this question, not just assume that the CRISPR technique doesn't cause off-target mutations, especially outside of the areas that they knew were at risk. This is at, you know, parts of the genome where they didn't realize were at risk. So clearly what we need, I think, is a study that does a pre and post treatment whole genome sequencing to definitively answer this question, how many off-target mutations are being caused. So essentially, this puts the study back into the unknown category. This is an issue. It's an open question, but this study didn't answer the question. It found an interesting finding, but not definitive. So more research is necessary. Thanks for writing in, Mark. All right, guys, let's go on to science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with 3 science news items or facts, 2 real and 1 fake, and then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. We have a theme this week. And if you guys didn't anticipate this theme, that's on you. because the theme is Vienna.
Yeah.
No.
Wunderbar.
And there are four items. You guys ready?
Yeah.
All right, yes. Here we go. Item number one. Vienna has a population of 1.8 million people, which is the same as its population in 1900 and represents over one quarter of the entire population of Austria. Item number two. Both the snow globe and the Pez dispenser were invented and first sold in Vienna. Item number three. Schönbrunn Palace, the summer home of the Habsburgs, was modest by European standards, containing 74 rooms. Item number four. In the old markets of Vienna, it was common to find monkey grooming services to pay to have a monkey remove lice and fleas from your head. Kara, you made a noise.
Damn it.
Kara, go first.
Mute is your friend.
Okay. Vienna has a population of 1.8 million. Sounds about right. Which is the same as its population in 1900. Does not sound right. And represents over one quarter of the entire population of Austria. Sounds about right. Okay. Seeing a red flag in the middle of that one. But both the snow globe and the Pez dispenser were invented and first sold in Vienna. Who knows? This one could be the death of me. How do I know such things? Ah, I suck at trivia. Okay, Schönbrunn Palace. The summer home of the Habsburgs was modest by European standards, containing 74 rooms. Well, modest in terms of a palace or just modest in terms of like any old house?
Yeah, in terms of a palace.
Okay. In the old markets of Vienna, it was common to find monkey grooming services to pay to have a monkey remove lice and fleas from your head. I really want that one to be true. I'm, this is all shot in the dark. So nobody follow my lead on this. Okay. But I'm going to say that the Schönbrunn Palace is the fiction. Maybe this palace is special because it had way more rooms than most castles.
Okay. Jay.
Vienna's population, 1.8 million. Steve says it's the same as it was in 1900. Wow. And, that's a quarter of the entire population of Austria. Yeah. I mean, okay. This has a lot of facts in it. Of course, the, you know, the population being 1.8 million back in 1900. I don't know why, you know, my gut is kind of doing the same that Kara's is, but I don't see that one as being too crazy. The next one here, the snow globe and the Pez dispenser were invented and first sold in Vienna. Pez dispenser, huh? I could see the snow globe, but the Pez dispenser. I mean, I could see, all right, this is another one, just like the first one. Like, okay, I mean, I don't have anything to really say yes or no to. The Pez dispenser does not feel like a Vienna-based artifact, but who am I to say? Schönbrunn Palace, 74 rooms. Yeah, I mean, when I was at the Medici castle slash palace in Italy, there was way more than 74 rooms, I think. So would that be considered big? Okay. Okay, I will continue on. In the old markets, Vienna was common to find monkey grooming services. What the hell? But why do they have all these monkeys? I mean, sure, I could see if there was a reason to have monkeys, then yes, business would follow. But what's with the monkeys? Why? Why in Vienna would they have monkeys? Oh, so the only thing I have to go on here is that Kara picked number three. Schönbrunn Palace. I mean, I don't know anything about any of this stuff, except I've spent time with Pez dispensers. I used to love them when I was a kid and eat reams of that candy. I will go with Kara simply because she's my only data point.
Thank you. Okay, Evan?
The population. So 1.8 million, same as 1900, and one quarter of the entire population. It's probably about right, one quarter of the population. And it's probably the same, maybe because, I don't know, two world wars maybe kind of had an impact on population growth in Austria, Vienna as well. May have, you know, been some extra people gone off to war and didn't come back. And that could have definitely had an impact to help keep the population from sort of rising, maybe as we think about other cities, major cities in Europe. So I think that one's right. And then the second one, snow globe and Pez dispenser invented and first sold in Vienna. I have a feeling this one's right as well. Pez is, there's a Pez distributor. It must be a distributor here in Connecticut. I think it's the U.S. headquarters for Pez, if in fact it is a European or even an Austrian, say, company. But I think it's here in Connecticut. I think that's about all I know about Pez. Oh, and the candy's disgusting. Third one, the Schönbrunn Palace. Yeah, this one could be the fiction. 74 rooms by no means is small. I'm trying to picture some of the other major palaces of Europe, and you know, I doubt that they're much larger than that. Maybe there are a few, but I don't know. When you start comparing them to other palaces, maybe not. And the monkey one, I mean, that's that's just too crazy to be the fiction. I mean, why would that be the fiction of all things, unless you totally made this up from your mind, Steve? So, I mean, that one's got to be science. That leaves the palace. That's got to be the fiction. That's it. Process of elimination done.
And Bob.
So Vienna has the same population in 1900. Now, does that... Yeah, that middle one is a bit of a red flag. Let's see. Yeah, and like Jay said, Pez, Vienna, what? Really? That doesn't follow. Doesn't seem quite right. And the monkey grooming, that's just such a wonderful idea. I'm just thinking the accessibility of monkeys going back, old markets, like what, 100, 200 years ago? I mean, really, it wouldn't be, they had money. I mean, sure, they could probably get their hands on a monkey.
I love this.
And I just love it. I want that to be true so badly as well. Yeah, I'm just leaning towards the palace because it seems easy just for that to be fake. Like, I know nothing about the Schönbrunn Palace, but maybe maybe it's got 500 rooms and blows away European standards. That seems
500?
Well, you know, I'm just saying. Maybe it's really extravagant, even by European standards. Far above and beyond any typical palaces. So maybe it's just such a standout that it's, you know, that this is way off. Yeah, I'm going to go with the crowd, say that Schönbrunn Palace is fiction.
Okay, so I'll take these in order.
What? Everybody agreed with me? What the hell's happening?
We'll start with...
We don't know shit either.
Carrie, you are responsible for our collective success
failure. Sweep is what's about to happen.
Oh, yeah, most likely he'll sweep.
Yeah,
we'll start with item number one. Vienna has a population of 1.8 million people, which is the same as its population in 1900 and represents over one quarter of the entire population of Austria. You guys all think that one is science, and that one is science. Actually, Vienna's population peaked in 1920 at just over 2 million, and it's actually dropped a little bit since then down to the level where it was at in around 1900. It really took off in the 1800s, like between 1800 and 1900 is when the population dramatically increased from about 100,000 to about 2 million. Wow. And then it's been stable, during the 20th century, pretty much. Dip after World War II, big time. It hasn't quite recovered to its pre-World War II numbers. It's the capital city of Austria, and it's like a quarter of the people in Austria live in Vienna.
The one that blows my mind the most is that it's the same as 1900, though.
Yeah.
That's a hard one to swallow.
Because, like, there are places, like, I think Honolulu has, like, 80% of the population of all of Hawaii, which is crazy. But there are places like that. But, it's crazy that it hasn't grown. It's grown everywhere else.
Okay, let's move on to number two. Both the snow globe and the Pez dispenser were invented first sold in Vienna. You guys all think this one is science. And this one is science.
Guys, 50% chance.
So not really, but that's okay.
That's the Monty Hall.
Yeah, the Monty Hall fallacy.
Oh, well, sort of.
Because I know what the right answer is.
So, Steve, are you saying, Steve, revealed, that we can switch to four if we'd like?
Would you like to?
No.
Now that we know that two of them are...
Well, you're going to...
I guess I'd have to go with the odds. And I would switch.
And switch.
But no. We'll follow the rules.
Okay. So Pez was first big. The candy came first, right? So Pez was invented by Eduard Haas. It's still sold by the Haas Company in Vienna, Austria, in 1927. The word Pez, P-E-Z, is an abbreviation for Pfefferminz. Which is German for peppermint.
Pfefferminz.
Jay.
Because originally they were peppermint. That's the only flavor that they came in. And they were breath mints, and they were sold in a little tin. And then...
Like Altoids today.
Then the Pez dispenser was invented by Oskar Uksa for the Haas Food Manufacturing Corporation. And they were... what do you think the Pez dispensers were made
deliberately to look like?
Dolls? Little soldiers, maybe, or dolls?
Think about their size and shape.
Well, they were made to look like cigarettes.
Cigarette lighter. That's correct.
Okay. There you go. Oops, yeah, I was going to say.
Because the slogan was that it was supposed to be an alternative to smoking. It's like no smoking, but pezzing, you know. So, like, instead of taking out your cigarette lighter, take out the Pez dispenser and you eat one of the Pez. That was the origin of the Pez dispenser. And you're right, Evan, that Pez built a large factory in Orange, Connecticut in 1983, yeah, which is right by where we live. But yeah, so the Pez dispenser invented in Vienna. And the snow globes, same thing. So invented in Vienna. Originally, the idea of the snow globe, they were looking for a way to improve the amount of light that a light bulb would give off. And so the flakes were supposed to reflect the light, and it completely failed. But it created a really pretty piece of kitsch, you know, that then it gets sold now in pretty much all around the world. So yeah, so the snow globe. And they did sell a lot of snow globes in Vienna. But of course, I didn't even really notice it because they sell them everywhere. But they still like hand make these really exquisite snow globes in Vienna. Let's move on to number three. Schönbrunn Palace, the summer home of the Habsburgs, was modest by European standards, containing 74 rooms. You guys all think this one is the fiction. Now, what if I told you how many rooms there were in Buckingham Palace? What do you guys think?
Oh, God.
100.
200?
200?
60.
Buckingham Palace has 775 rooms.
What? Oh, no.
700?
How is that possible?
Wow. 700. Wow.
There are probably so many dead bodies in that building no one even knows.
Oh, yeah.
700.
700?
Right, 700. When I said 500, you laughed. Character.
I know.
Schönbrunn Palace has, are you ready for this? 1,441 rooms.
Yeah, baby.
Yes. 1,400.
I got it right for the wrong reason.
So clearly I made the wrong one, the fiction this week. Because if I had gone with that, see, to me, I'm like, oh yeah, 1,400 rooms. Yeah, don't all those palaces have hundreds and hundreds of rooms? I figured you guys would figure that out right away. But apparently I was wrong.
Yeah, wow. Baby.
So we got the tour of Schönbrunn Palace. They showed us through 40 rooms, but that was 40 out of 1,441 rooms.
You just That's barely crazy. Scratched the
it
surface.
Was massive, gorgeous, massive, with surrounded by these beautiful gardens and a maze. It was just really incredible.
And that was their summer home?
Yeah. This was during the empire, right? The Hungary, Austria, whatever empire.
Austria,
yeah.
Hungary.
At that time, I think that the empire, which survived over 600 years, you know, the emperor or empress lived in the castle. Yeah, they were fabulously wealthy, obviously. And you could tell from obviously looking at the palace, you know, how much wealth they had at the time. It was really beautiful, actually. I thought the palace was very good. Obviously, always when you're touring these old buildings, they don't have the same kind of creature comforts that we take for granted. And, you know, even with all of the wealth, you know, like their bathrooms are terrible. But
yeah, they're still using chamber pots. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Like this palace had one of the first toilets in Europe there, and it was just in the prince's bedroom, and it was still a piece of crap. It was still like splintery little, the kind of thing, like if that were a porta potty at a Ren Fair, you'd be like, what the hell is this?
Oh, it's like an outhouse.
Actually just like a little more than an outhouse. But, you know, obviously beautiful architecture, beautiful, you know, artwork, some, you know, incredible woodwork, you know, just really, really beautiful. All right, let me read number four. In the old markets of Vienna, it was common to find monkey grooming services to pay to have a monkey remove lice and fleas from your head. That is science. I learned that because there's a painting in Schönbrunn Palace that actually shows that happening. So it's pretty good evidence. The guy's leaning over with his head and there's a monkey grooming his head. Now, the person giving us the tour followed that up with another piece of information. I almost made this the fiction, but I wanted to I didn't know if you guys would buy the whole monkey grooming thing, but she said, and that's where we get the name flea markets from. And as soon as she said it, I said, that's got to be bullshit. I just that's one of those things. Because when you hear stuff like that from a tour guide, most of this, a lot of the stuff that tour guides tell you that are folksy are not true. I would be very skeptical of it. So as soon as I heard that, I'm like, I bet you that's one of those bullshit things that tour guides say that is not true.
So did you look it up?
Of course I looked it up. And it's not true.
Right there.
Yeah, it's not true. So we kind of know what the origin of the term flea market was, although there is some debate about it. But the first reference to it is from Paris, you know, obviously in the French, but the term literally translates to flea market. And that was because it was, you know, like what we think of today, just people selling their own wares. And oftentimes they were, you know, of low quality. And the fleas refer to the literal fleas in like tapestries and furniture. You know, they would be flea infested. Mm-hmm. So that's what became known as the flea market. But such markets existed, you know, in India and China and Bangladesh for a long time before that. So that wasn't the origin of the markets themselves. And then there's an alternate theory is that in the 18th century in New York City, there was the fly market derived from the Dutch word vlei, meaning swamp or valley. So because New York was very swampy, so it was like the swamp market, and the word got mistranslated to fly market or flea market. But I think that the French theory is much better. It did not come from Vienna. It did not come from monkeys picking lice off of people's heads or whatever. Could you imagine pretty much everyone was basically lice infested at that time?
I mean, I think about how bad people smelled.
I know.
Oh, and their teeth. Jay, right? The teeth.
Forget about it.
No deodorant. Took showers.
Whenever you watch a period film like from 200-300 years ago and you see how people all have perfect teeth and they're healthy. Forget about it. At that time, everyone was a wreck, right? Most people must have had like horrible teeth, boils everywhere. just think of all the stuff you've had in your life that you've treated and got better, you know? Yeah. But imagine now you were just think about every little thing you had happen to you in your life. And if you didn't have modern treatment for it, right, you'd be a mess.
Mm-hmm.
You really think it was that bad?
Yeah, I do. All right, how about this, Jay? You know, like when at the time when people wore the wigs, like when wigs were really all the rage, and they had these big elaborate wigs, and they would have to spray them to keep them in place. That rats loved to make nests in them. In their wigs. Rats would make nests in their wigs. They had to put a rat cage over their wig at night to keep the rats away.
Oh my God!
That's what we're talking about, Jay. They were embedded in nature in a way that we could not imagine living in our modern world. Isn't that funny to think about?
Oh, forget it, man. That's why whenever people say, "Hey, if you could go to anywhere, you know, in time, where would you go?" and I always say, "The future."
The future. I'll roll those dice.
Yeah. Right, where we have some germs under control.
Ew. Oh, yeah, back in the day, women had to wear merkins. You guys know what merkins are, right?
No, enlighten us.
They're Americans.
Merkins are... I just thought of it because Steve mentioned the wigs and the rats and the wigs. Merkins are vagina wigs.
Oh, that's right. You had to shave all your hair down there because infested with nasty critters and cooties.
And then you would wear a wig to cover it up. One. Or prostitutes would wear them because they were so, like, they had so many diseases. They wanted to cover the signs of the disease.
An 18th century prostitute. Forget
so
it.
Forget it.
Oh my gosh.
So gross. I love it.
It's amazing anybody survived those days.
I know.
All right, guys. Well, good job. You got my Vienna trivia, science or fiction.
Thank you.
Yeah.
All right, Evan, give us a quote.
This week's quote was offered up by listener Glenn Bach. Thank you, Glenn. We appreciate it. People almost invariably arrive at their beliefs, not on the basis of proof, but on the basis of what they find attractive. Yes, yes. Written by Blaise Pascal.
That's a timely quote, because I wrote recently about a study looking at the desirability bias, which is actually even stronger than the confirmation bias. We believe what we want to be true, you know, we'll accept information if it supports what we want to be true, even more than if it supports what we already believe to be true. But it's actually more complicated than that. If you want to learn all about it, read my blog post on the topic. All right. Well, thank you all for joining me this week.
Sure. Roger that.
Thanks, Steve.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible.